Hey y'all, how's it going? I'm Scott Horton. Welcome to my show, the Scott Horton Show, here on the Liberty Radio Network. Thanks for tuning in. Check out the website, scotthorton.org. I keep all my interview archives there. Hey, and the whole show archives, too. You can sign up for the podcast feeds. Hey, sign up for the podcast feeds. You can get the whole show archives or just the interviews, either way. Join up the chat room. That's scotthorton.org/chat. You don't need an external application, just a plain old browser window, scotthorton.org/chat. If you want to put in a fake name and a CAPTCHA and talk with the boys and girls. Hey, guys. Also, I'm on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. If you don't mind getting your feelings hurt sometimes. I'm pretty rude on there, I guess. You know what, though? You guys get off easy. There's a lot that I think of tweeting and think better of tweeting, too. So that's good. Got a good show lined up for you today. Will Gregg is going to be here, which means that I'm going to try. I shouldn't jinx it, but oh well. I'm going to try very hard to shut my mouth and let the man talk. He's got a lot of great things to say. Very important things for you to hear, I think. William Norman Gregg will be on the show. Also, Jason Ditz, news editor at antiwar.com. Okay, that's not for sure yet, but yeah, probably. I'm hoping so. To talk about the Korea thing and the Islamic State. The Korea thing. You got to cover it. I mean, I'm sorry. I know. Don't worry. We're not going to gossip all about the movie and whatever. Is the accusations against the foreign state. We're going to be focused. I wonder, does anybody have a good feeling? Chat room guys, do you have a good feeling for what percentage of the American people, you know, heard of and or were buying the North Korea did this shtick? I wonder what percent of listeners to this show believed for even a moment that North Korea was behind this thing. And honestly, I wonder what was the belief in the general population just because TV said the FBI said. And I know Americans will believe pretty much anything as long as it isn't correct. And especially if TV says that government says so. But, I don't know. It's so stupid and obvious. Seems like maybe this is one that could have maybe bounced off the people's head for a minute. Oh, wait a minute. North Korea do all this upset about a movie you claim, huh? Oh, the FBI says so, huh? I don't know. I just never was that impressed. I wonder, how many people were buying that. I wonder how to measure that. I don't know. Anyway, so Jason Ditz will be on to talk a little bit about that, and then really I would rather talk to him about the war, so talk to him about the war too. And then James Carden is going to be on, and you know, I need to Google him up because he's a contributing editor to the National Interest, but I don't know what else he is. But I know he's written for the American Conservative magazine before. Yeah, here he is at the American Conservative. Oh, and The Nation. Isn't that interesting? And let's see here. Don't have much of a bio. Oh, quite an archive at the American Conservative, more than I realized. Oh, yeah, he's the guy that wrote this thing. All right. Well, anyway, so he's been writing interesting stuff about Russia. Here, he's got a little bit more of a bio. He's a contributing editor to the American Conservative magazine and served as an advisor to the U.S.-Russia Bilateral Presidential Commission at the State Department from 2011 to 2012. Huh. All right. So that'll be interesting. And you know what? Call that my New Year's resolution. I'm going to try to really get better on lining up guests on America's relationship with Russia, which is, after all, the most important issue in the whole world. That's not even an opinion. That's just a mathematical, scientifical type of a fact. I guess assuming the premise that you care about the future existence of the human species. Yeah, America and Russia, we gotta get along. We got to. because of the H-bombs. That's what I'm getting at, the H-bombs. Those are the mean kind that make A-bombs look like the nice kind. Imagine that, the bomb that killed Nagasaki being the good cop to the H-bomb that could kill the biggest cities in America in one shot. I mean, not all of them in one shot, but each with one shot. Anyway, yeah. America and Russia, I got to do better at compiling guests to talk about Russia and what can be done. And I don't know, I guess, you know what, I'm going to have to go ahead and somehow iron things out with Robert Perry. I guess I'm embarrassed, but I need to get over my embarrassment. I mean, he should be embarrassed too. He wrote the most ridiculous things about libertarianism. It's just completely ridiculous. Especially for someone whose enemy are avowed centrist extremists, bipartisan conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans who would wage world empire till we're all dead. But anyway, man, he's been so great on Russia and Ukraine for the last year straight, a little bit more than that even. And if you go to consortiumnews.com or go to Google, whatever search engine, type site:consortiumnews.com. You don't need a HTTP in there or anything. Just site:consortiumnews.com, Ukraine. And go spend an hour reading that, reading up. And, you know, you'll learn it well. So I got to bury the hatchet with old Robert Perry. You know, Ray said he's probably not even mad anyway. I wrote him a nasty email calling him an idiot kind of thing. But I got to fix that so I can interview him. Because, hey, America's relationship with Russia is the most important thing in the world. Not my stupidity, which is second or third most important. Okay. Yeah. And then, so this guy, Cardin, yeah, he's going to be on. And, you know, Margulies, he knows a hell of a lot about Russia, too. I need to interview him more about Russia. But I'm going to try to get better on that. You know, the Middle East stuff is huge. And there's a huge new war coming. But it's only just gotten started, the war against the Islamic State. It is only just getting going. But the war with, even a Cold War with Russia. You know, Henry Kissinger gave an interview to Der Spiegel, and he said, if we have a real renewal of the Cold War with Russia, that would be such a tragedy. After we were able to put that to bed. The Cold War, that wasn't good old days. It was horrible. That's what it was. And like the war on terrorism, it was the excuse for that many outrages, as many outrages here at home. For wars, the health of the state and a totalitarian bureaucracy within our shores for the duration of the emergency, as William F. Buckley put it. Even with Truman, could have meant Obama, at the reins of it all. And anyway, so Kissinger, when Henry Kissinger is saying, oh man, you guys got Putin all wrong here. Let's get it straight. Let's not base our policy on our spin. Let's at least be honest, you know, ruling in ruling circles. Let's be honest about what it is we've done and how we made it this way so that at least we can figure out what to do going forward. We're not really going to base our policy on our giant pile of crap that we told CNN to repeat to everybody, are we? That was Kissinger's thing. Putin didn't start this. America started it. That's not even a secret. It's just collectively denied in D.C., where it takes a Henry Kissinger to contradict them and tell them, hey, dial it back a little bit. Anyway. God dang thing. Empire's picking the worst fight they could possibly pick in the whole world. I mean, China, they got a couple of dozen nukes. Russia's got thousands. Get it? Like America. Thousands. Hey, everybody. Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking and war,
Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/ScottHortonShow for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there.
All right, you guys, well, I just got the Liberty Crier morning email there from Trevor Lyman there at libertycrier.com. Sorry for saying there so many times like that. That was kind of ridiculous, wasn't it? Anyway, libertycrier.com. That's where I get a lot of my news of the horrors of the American police state. And before I introduce Will Grigg, let me just go ahead and mention a few stories to you so that I end up hopefully sparing Will Grigg and you the displeasure of hearing me talk about all these stories during his interview. Maybe one or two of them will come up, but anyway. First of all, go look at Radley Balco at the Washington Post. His blog is called The Watch, and I don't know how often they actually publish him in the paper, but it's a great website for him to be writing at, and he's just great on police abuse issues there at the Washington Post. Radley Balco, horrifying civil liberties predictions for 2015. And I'll spoil it for you because you'll be able to tell from the first link that the joke is all these are absolutely horrifying civil liberties violations that happened this year in 2014. And just as kind of a listicle of horrible things about the cops that happened this year that you heard of once or twice and then forgot about because you just can't remember all of them. There's so many. And he's reminding us. And it's just ridiculous. And especially he highlights a lot of the court decisions upholding these outrages. And just by the end of the thing, you'll weep for what you remember America used to be, even if you're a kid and you can only remember a few years back. I mean, we're just so out of control here. It's ridiculous. I like this headline. NYPD arrests plummet 66% as cops are in a virtual work stoppage. Now, if that's true, that's great, because what it's going to prove immediately is that New York doesn't really need the NYPD. Not like this. They could do without them, without 90% of them. They could probably arrange their own security services without having a government monopoly on it in the first place. But anyway, even as far as the NYPD, as it serves as an occupying army in those boroughs, for them to stop work just means that people can be free for a little while. And this is going to really blow up in their faces because, one, as the New York Times editorial put it, it makes them look like such self-pitying, crybaby, whiner bullies when their job is to be servants, not to dictate to the population or to the population's elected representatives. And they are making themselves look like clowns more than actual victims that anybody ought to feel sorry for. And that's certainly true. And they're going to prove to the people in New York just how unnecessary they really are, which I think is hilarious too. And no doubt about it. It's not like crime is going to go through the window now. Especially if the cops are gone, then people are free to carry weapons, you know, in a concealed fashion. And then criminals are taking a big risk, aren't they? All right, anyway. So this is good news. Rand Paul, his staff confirms that they are going to introduce legislation, which they don't say exactly what, and I apologize, this is a WorldNet Daily article. Oh, I see. They talked to BuzzFeed. That was the original source here. They talked to BuzzFeed. They said they're going to introduce a bill, and apparently it is going to aim, I may be oversimplifying it, okay, here, because I don't think that the article is so specific. I think, generally speaking, what they're talking about here is ending the 1033 program, which is the, funnel all the military surplus equipment to the police departments from the Pentagon to the local cops. And I think that whatever this is, it probably does not go so far as to abolish it, but to somehow begin to roll it back or something, I guess, is something. Obviously, things have gotten way out of control here. All right, New York Times, in Brooklyn gun cases, suspicion turns to the police. And that is, and this is for all you gun control liberals out here, here are black men being framed by the cops for gun possession charges. It's a lot harder to frame somebody for shooting somebody, for doing something with a gun. But, yep, he's black, and we arrested him, and oh, looky what we have here, a drop gun. That's good enough to put a man in prison. In the state penitentiary, possibly for years, depending on his previous record of trumped up crap. Or actual crimes. I presume people innocent, you see. I'm an old kind of American. I only presume the government guilty, because that's what it means to be the government. But anyway, yeah, here in the New York Times. And driven by people protesting in the streets, we're sick and tired of this crap. They're covering this, and obvious drop gun cases here. Of course, the cops are going to get away with it, but maybe these guys will get out of jail. Trooper of the year, raped a little girl 4 times, a Maine state trooper, a 4-year-old little girl. And, during his trial, he had, you know, like a wedding where everybody shows up to support at the trial. His entire, all his pews were full with the butts of other cops, cops' wives, the family, the community, rallying his community. And the police and the government are such a huge segment of our society under that We the People mythology that they foist on us that, oh yeah, no, the place was packed of people coming out to support the multiple count child rapist cop. Trooper of the year. They love him. They don't care whose little girl he raped. He's a cop. He can rape whoever they want, whoever he wants, they cry. Oh no, it was out of character. It was only because of the stress of protecting us at his cop job that made him do it, his lawyer cried. And the peanut gallery whooped and cheered and love it. Just like in Cleveland, where the cops recently killed a 12-year-old boy in possession of a pellet gun in an open carry state. Well, it looked like a real gun. Yeah, well, people have the right to carry a gun in Ohio, which is part of America, and which specifically allows for the carrying of firearms. Well, we didn't know he was 12. We thought he was 20. Yeah, so... So, as far as you knew, he had every right to have a gun. What are you talking about? Well, anyway, don't worry, because you wouldn't believe me if I, just from describing it, I have to tell you the web address. You go and check at cleveland.com, covering Northeast Ohio. Cleveland pro-police rally draws thousands, including family members of fallen officers. And I love how in the picture there's one black guy, too, marching with him. One token black guy with him. Hey, and that looks like Pat Lang's Twitter pic. That's funny. Anyway, there are, no doubt, thousands of people here marching in support of the cops that murdered a 12-year-old boy. Here's a cop who threatened to put this girl in jail if she wouldn't let him take nude pictures of her. The only reason she was protected is because she had family who were cops who helped her. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Hey, I got Will Grigg on the line. William Norman Grigg, that is. The great author of the book, Liberty in Eclipse. He does Freedom Zealot Radio, and he writes at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. The blog is called Pro Libertate. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Welcome back to the show, Will. How you doing?
Scott, I'm doing great. I hope you had a very nice Christmas.
I did. How was yours?
Ours was wonderful. Thank you.
That's great. Yeah, yeah. Very happy to hear it. Happy New Year and all those kinds of things.
You as well. Thank you.
Yeah. So, man, I don't know if you saw Balco this morning with his predictions for next year.
Yes, and, I did.
And it's all really the year in review. I'll spoil the joke because it's spoiled in the first link, so who cares, right? His year in review. Boy, what a year 2014 for the police state out of control. And he didn't even mention Mike Brown in there, right? Didn't even mention Eric Garner, because
exactly.
those are the ones that are on everybody's radar. But he reminded us of all the outrages that have gone by in the last year. It really is something. And I guess, well, I want to talk to you about your article, Law and Order Leninism. I guess really that is the best place to start, is...
Yep.
The question of the divide between right and left on this issue, where they just can't admit to each other that they agree with each other and that the enemy is the police state and that they could work together
right.
on this. It's us, you know, the Americans here. We could have a consensus. And yet, as you say, they're all wrapped up in Leninism. Well, how so?
They're all wrapped up in a tribalist version of Leninism. Leninism, as I defined it in this essay, is digested into two maxims, the first of which is that government gets to exercise power without limit, resting directly on force, unlimited by law. And the second of which is that in politics, the most important question is who does what to whom. Now, Lenin wrote voluminously and in self-contradictory fashion about a number of subjects, but I think in terms of the way that he exercised power as the founding ruler of Soviet Russia, those two maxims define how he conducted himself and defined the doctrine that has been adopted pretty much seamlessly by every government of consequence since 1917, our own very much emphatically included on that list. So what you have here is a situation where people who have been assigned or who have chosen one of two identifiable political camps in this country, one of two very identifiable factions, they've adopted these two maxims and the way that they relate to the police state that is now very much an overt and undeniable presence in our society is that they are situational Leninist. That is to say, when they are on the receiving end of government violence, or somebody they associate with their tribe is on the receiving end of government violence, then they will rend the skies with outraged cries over the unfairness of it all. On the other hand, if somebody who's identified with the other faction is on the receiving end of such violence, then people who otherwise would be inclined to criticize the police state insist that the problem is that those people are not submitting to the due and proper authority of the government as embodied in the police officer. So last April, you had left progressives talk about Clive and Bundy and his supporters as domestic terrorists when they were involved in an uprising based on tax disputes in Clark County, Nevada. And you had conservatives extolling Clive and Bundy and his followers and supporters as essentially the renaissance of the colonial spirit of 1776. And that all happened around Easter. And by Christmas, suddenly the narrative is reversed. And you have the same right that had celebrated Clive and Bundy.
By summer,
but certainly by Christmas. I mean, by Christmas there was no ambiguity because Eric Garner's case is one in which you've got somebody dealing with exactly the same kind of challengers that Clive and Bundy was dealing with, having to do with tax policy. The difference is that you have this guy who was seeking a subsistence level living on the streets of Staten Island by selling untaxed single cigarettes, who's literally killed in front of a video camera by a thug scrum of police officers who begin with an illegal chokehold and then allow him to sit there dying on the sidewalk with his hands cuffed. This all happens on video in front of the public. And for about two or three days after the grand jury decided not to indict Pantaleo for the criminal homicide of Eric Garner, for about two or three days, there was this brief tremor of something very close to decency on the part of the Fox-centered right, where you had people like Bill O'Reilly saying, I just can't countenance what was done to this guy. And then the party line reasserted itself. Oh, the problem was he resisted. He resisted a police officer. Doesn't matter whether or not what they were doing to him was justified. It doesn't matter whether or not the tax policy is something that is wholesome or worthwhile. You don't resist the police. Well, these are the same people who were cheering when Clive and Bundy's associates were pointing guns at Clark County police officers, Las Vegas Metro police officers, back in April of this year. And, of course, you've got the left now, quite properly, in my opinion, making this a cause célèbre, where they're peacefully opposing and peacefully criticizing the rampant and impenitent violence of the NYPD and other police departments, and yet they're being treated as if they're elements of a revolutionary action. Some of these people, as you pointed out, Scott, are trying to hijack this issue on behalf of superannuated nostrums of 1968 vintage Marxist leftism. That much is true, but you know what? I don't really care. If they're making the focus of this the need to rein in these agents of state-sanctioned violence, then to that extent, I'm comfortable in their company. But unfortunately, one of the other things that's happening here, this is something we predicted and talked about, is that this is being repurposed into a matter of what is referred to as racial politics in this country. This is being treated as if the real question here is either white privilege or black entitlement. You know, somehow this is being transposed into an issue of skin color and melanin content, when the real issue has to be the unfettered criminal violence of police departments acting as agents of the state. And the real enemy here is the embedded privilege of people who dispense violence on behalf of this murderous fiction that is commonly known as the state. But neither side is critiquing the state here. They're critiquing each other. And that's precisely the conversation that the people who presume to rule us want us to have.
Yeah, it really is too bad, especially when it's just so obvious like this. But I guess, you know, where I always look at, you know, generally speaking, I know most Americans probably don't identify very well with left or right or even know necessarily what those things are supposed to mean.
Sure.
That kind of thing, you know, but typically speaking, people who more or less lean left or right, I say about half of them are more or less libertarian and are the good part of the right, or, you know, more or about
yeah.
approximately half are more or less the good part of the left. And it's not even necessarily separated by moderate and radical either, but just principled and not, you know what I mean? Like Glenn Greenwald, he's basically a middle of the road Democrat, except
sure.
on the Bill of Rights, he's hardcore. That's all.
That's exactly right.
You know what I mean? But otherwise, he's not a very radical figure. He's just, you know, he more or less is you know, basic democratic politics seems
pretty conventional.
Be,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, that's just one example. But so the point being that, you know, you have, I don't know if maybe half is too generous, but you do have portions of the left and the right who see these things more or less the way you do, that, hey, you know, if you know, Bush's government abused people, then the Obama government shouldn't be abusing people and saying, well, Bush did it too. They should
mm-hmm.
be not abusing people the way Bush did, you know, and so there's, you know, some of the people are closer to the tribal identification and would rather see the power exercised. But it seems like these are great teachable moments for people like you and me, too, to say, like, you know, seriously, we got your local sheriff is carrying an M16 around like it's the Battle of Fallujah. What the hell is going on here? That's not necessarily a racial issue. And oh, well, I'm sorry. One more thing. It's really hard for people to address this. Oh, and now the break's coming up too. Wonderful. It's hard for people to address the racial issue because, of course, to people who are racial minorities who've been suffering police abuse all along, it sure looks like it's a racial issue to them. Well, why wouldn't it be? It's the same racial issue it always has been. But
yeah,
what's new is
that.
Yeah, yeah. What's new is that the cops are beating the hell and killing out of and killing white people too now, because that's how out of control they are. So it's
yeah,
up to all of us to roll them back now. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'll let you talk for 10 minutes in just a sec.
Okay.
Will Grigg, y'all.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show.
I'm Scott Horton. I'm sitting here laughing. You guys follow Mitch Lake on Twitter? I don't know who that guy is, but he cracks me up, man. All right. So listen here. Here's some things that Will Grigg wrote recently. I should not be doing radio. I'm just not qualified for this. You got to be able to talk to do radio. Will wrote some things here. Why support your local police is a formula for despotism. Also, law and order Leninism, which is the one we're talking about here. Who does what to whom? And then a peace officer defies the blue tribe, the exile of Officer Cariel Horn. And that's a really good one. It's about some other cops who tried to do the right thing a couple of times, too. And I got to tell you, Will, he's just such a talented writer. He's as good as he is at talking with the keypad there. And I really do hope that you'll bookmark his great blog, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And let me go ahead and mention now, Will, before I turn it back over to you, that there's a money bomb going on for Will that AJ Ellis has set up. It's a really easy address to get to. It's just gofundme.com/JA1140. That's pretty easy, right? gofundme.com/JA1140, or just Google Will Grigg Money Bomb and you'll find it there at gofundme.com, and trying to raise a couple of grand there. It's a good little project by AJ. I hope that you guys will participate in that. Get the new year off to a right start. Supporting independent journalism like Will's. Okay, so I'm sorry. I loaded a bunch of stuff on you there about the good part of the left and the good part of the right, and how can we teach them to get it right so we can really do something to roll back these cops. And what about race? Because hasn't it always been about race ever since the days of the slave catchers? And when did it quit being about race? And what about that divide, too, within the left and right? I see there are people who say, stop saying Black Lives Matter, all lives matter. And there are people saying, see, Black people can't have anything.
Yeah.
You know, you don't even want Black people. It's not like they're saying only Black people's lives matter. They're protesting that Black people's lives matter, too. Mm-hmm. But even that gets turned into something else by some Madison Avenue white guy PR firm, you know?
I do appreciate the fact that you bring up the slave catchers of the 1850s, because as far as I can tell in the research that I've done, the emergence of the idea of resisting arrest being a crime occurred during the 1850s in the context of people who were trying to help human beings escape from people who claimed to hold those human beings as property. And you had U.S. Marshals and deputized law enforcement officers treating resistance to their attempt to capture these so-called fugitive slaves and remand them to the custody of their supposed owners as if it were a crime. And when you see somebody like Eric Garner being arrested precisely for asserting self-ownership, this is the most important part of the story. It stops today. You're always harassing me. Leave me alone. In other words, he was telling people who presumed to own him, and that's something that's being peddled now by elements of the right with respect to the Eric Garner case. He was telling people to presume to own him that he owned himself and that he was minding his own business, and he invited them to mind their own. And he was being punished for contempt of cop. Right. There was no
evidence. Reminder here that he had just broken up a fight was what caught their attention. And as you said, when you mentioned before, the right winger saying, oh, he was resisting, in a sense. But by resisting, what that really means is he put his hands up so as to prove he wasn't a threat. But
exactly.
But he was holding them up there stiffly instead of putting them behind his back.
He was doing something other than rendering immediate and unqualified submission to a police officer. In the last week or so, Jeffrey Fulmer, who's a police union commissar in Cleveland, has said in so many words that you do whatever a cop tells you to do. And you've had Rudy Giuliani saying the same thing on Meet the Press over the weekend. My father told me that whatever a cop tells you do it, whether it's right or not. Well, Rudolph Giuliani's father, as it turns out, was a crook. He was a petty thief who went to jail because he was ripping people off. So perhaps Rudy Giuliani's father's perspective on this issue was jaundiced by a bad conscience. He probably was doing something that would warrant the attention of a police officer, unlike Eric Garner, who, as you said, just broke up a fight acting as a peacemaker, while you had undercover police operatives who were tatted out. The guy, Daniel Pantaleo, who actually killed Eric Garner, had full sleeves of tattoos. He looked like the sort of a person whose company you'd want to avoid in any circumstance. The fact that he was a cop merely accentuates that quality about him. But they were in the neighborhood trying to find people who were conducting commerce without government permission. Eric Garner was acting as a peacemaker, and that's what brought him to the attention of those police officers. He raised his hands in noncompliance, but also by way of showing that he was not armed. And this is treated as if it were a capital offense on the basis of what we might call the Jeffrey Fulmer Doctrine. He didn't render immediate, unqualified submission to a police officer the way that a fugitive slave was supposed to render unqualified submission to a slave catcher in the 1850s. So yes, there is a very strong racial element to all this. And one of the things you brought up in the earlier segment, Scott, was the fact that you're seeing what we might call the gentrification of the ghetto here in terms of violent police tactics and the mentality of a military occupation seeping out from the inner city, from the hood, into the suburbs. And that's one of the reasons why this issue has achieved a certain saliency over the last few years, is because people of means who have, among other things, the technological capacity to record their interactions with police have made visible and vivid what has been going on. And the fact that these casual instances of criminal violence by police are targeting people other than the familiar suspects in the inner city. And that's one of the reasons why, beginning about a year and a half or so ago, I said that we're going to be reaching what I call peak jackboot, which is that point in our society's development where we're no longer beguiled by the official line that police are actually protecting us, when actually what they're doing is acting as the enforcement arm of a government that preys upon our persons and property. Mm-hmm. And I think that we've reached that point now, but that doesn't mean that things are going to be getting better for the foreseeable future. You know, Bradley Balko's piece this morning in the Washington Post, which is something he's done before, and it's a brilliant journalistic conceit where you have him making predictions as to how bad things will get by showing that these things have all happened. That's really the chronicle of a country where people have this increasingly vivid awareness of what our rulers are doing on the one hand, and our rulers becoming more impudent and brazen in doing what they've always done, acting in the serene confidence that there's not a whole lot that we can do to oppose them. And one of the things that they have done brilliantly, I suspect, is co-opted this tribalism that they have so diligently cultivated for decades now. And I do think that you're correct, Scott, in talking about the fact that the vast bulk of the American public doesn't consciously identify with a political faction because most of us are too busy living our lives. And politics, of course, as Oscar Wilde said, would take too many weekends, take too many evenings, I think was what he said. Mm. There are other things we want to do with our time other than becoming obsessed with the idea of who's going to exercise power on behalf of one faction or another. But, of course, that seeds the field of the people who are most motivated and most eager to exercise power basically against everybody who's not part of their cohort. There is a huge, what we might call a golden rule constituency in the American public. I think it's probably a majority. People who understand that the fundamental maxim of civilized life is do unto others as you would be done to, or at least don't do to somebody what you yourself find to be abhorrent. And politics tends to be an exercise in pursuing self-seeking or self-benefiting exceptions to the golden rule. And unfortunately, we have this huge industry of talk radio and cable television devoted to facile tribalist controversies in ways that, of course, happen to harmonize with Lenin's dictum of who does what to whom. Mm-hmm. And so the political conversation is taking place on one track. The social conversation, perhaps, is taking place in a slightly different way. But the danger we confront in trying to teach people correct principles here is the fact that we're going to politicize people's outlooks rather than getting them to think in terms of fundamental principles having to do with individual liberty and dignity and property rights. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to transcend the political in discussing these things and just to get people to look at what's going on with eyes that are not beguiled by official titles and official terminology.
Right.
One of the most useful things about social media here is that it has pulled away the veil that had protected what Edmund Burke called the mysteries of policy through which official violence is somehow transmuted into virtue and justice. You know, when you have a police officer who's beating on somebody or tasering somebody or killing somebody, most people now still see this as somebody who is set apart, sanctified from the rest of society, doing something that is justified because he does it. but there's a growing understanding on the part of the public that you're seeing one individual commit an act of violence against another individual, and they're trying to assess it in those terms, mm-hmm. those terms that have been completely divested of all these artificial categories that would make the aggressor, and we have to assume that he's the aggressor until proven otherwise,
right.
make the aggressor somehow the noble dispenser of justice.
Hey, is there any chance you want to do one more segment with me here today, Will?
Sure.
Okay, great. Well, hold on. It's about 7-8 minutes, this long break for the top of the hour.
Okay.
So go ahead, take a break, put the phone down, and we'll be back with you then. It's the great Will Grigg, y'all, on the Scott Horton Show.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. Check out Will Grigg's great blog, Pro Libertate, at freedomandourtime.blogspot.com. Why support your local police is a formula for despotism. Law and order, Leninism. And a peace officer defies the blue tribe, the exile of Officer Cariel Horn. A shocking but not surprising story there. Always great journalism at Pro Libertate, freedomandourtime.blogspot.com. The great Will Grigg. All right, so here's the thing. I forget exactly where I interrupted you, Will, but I know what I wanted to say next, which is that as much as race is important in all of this, as we discussed, I think, and this was the context in which you brought it up in the first place, I think, was that it's obscuring what's really important here. And you mentioned basic principle, never mind politics, basic principle. That's what people need to get back to here. Innocent till proven guilty, fairness, justice, honesty is what's going on here. I got one, accountability. This is what we're lacking. This is what does not exist, is accountability for cops. You know, I got one here, cop speeding at night without his lights on, kills 10-year-old boy on his way to a sleepover in the crosswalk. And we all already know he's going to get away with it with not even a slap on the wrist. We all already know he's not going to be in trouble for this, even though he killed this 10-year-old boy. And it's all his fault, and he's a criminal. And if he wasn't a cop, he'd go to prison for it. But he is a cop, and so he will not get in trouble, and that's a scientific fact, and we all know it. And so that's what's got to change. That's what the left and the right and everybody has got to rally around. And so how do we do that? Because I don't think just hashtag accountability is going to quite get it done here. What do we do?
There are several things that I proposed recently that I think would be not dispositive of the problem you're describing, but go a long way toward making it manageable. The first of which is that we have to do away with this spurious construct called qualified immunity. And qualified immunity is that magical property that makes a police officer unaccountable, but a private security officer accountable to the law. To give you one really good illustration, just last week there were two former private security officers in Dayton, Ohio, who were sentenced to at least 4 years in prison for an incident in 2012 in which they fired 17 shots at a car carrying a fleeing so-called suspect, a young man by the name of Dante Price, who's 20 at the time. He'd been trespassed out of the apartment complex these two security officers were patrolling. They had the right to a victim from the property, but they surrounded the car and ordered him out of the vehicle onto the ground the way the police officers familiarly do. They do that all the time. It's something that's not dictated by law. It's a matter of policy. It's done in the name of the sacred imperative of officer safety. And so they were behaving like police officers rather than private security officers. Mr. Price refused to get out of the car, and then he put the car in gear and started to flee. The two of them opened fire on the vehicle, hitting him three times out of the 17 shots that they flung in his direction. They called 911. They claimed that they had a violent suspect who tried to run them down. What happened is that they were actually indicted by a grand jury, and then facing the prospect of life in prison, they took a plea bargain agreement that would result in a four-year prison sentence. Now, every single one of the facts of that case could be transposed instantly into any one of a number of cases I've written about involving police officers. The Daniel Willard case in Utah, for instance, is a really good match for this. The difference is that these two people were employed by Ranger Security Company rather than by the Dayton Police Force. And if they had been employed by the Dayton PD, there's no way they would have faced an indictment. This would have been immediately ruled justified by the police department, most likely within an hour or so of the incident. And they would invoke their Garrity privilege and talk to the Internal Affairs Division to tell what had happened from their perspective. Nothing they disclosed would have been available for the prosecutors. And they would have invoked qualified immunity, and that would have been the end of the matter. But because they were employed to protect persons and property rather than to enforce the edicts of the municipal government of Dayton, Ohio, these two individuals were held criminally accountable for an act of criminal homicide. That's the sort of thing that should obtain when you're talking about any kind of an incident involving any people who are police officers or private security guards. They should be treated equally by the law. That's just a fundamental American principle of equality before the law. Another thing I've suggested is that police officers, as a professional responsibility, an indispensable professional requirement, carry personal liability insurance for any episodes that might involve abuse of a citizen or brutality or something of that sort. And this would be connected to a third proposal, which would be that any civil judgment involving police brutality or police abuse should be paid out of the pension fund of the union and the department employing the miscreant officer. They don't have any skin in the game right now. They indemnify their acts by forcing the tax victims of the jurisdiction to pay for the civil judgments in the form of increased premiums for risk management insurance for the police department. That's actually driven some cities into bankruptcy. That happened to Maywood, California, a number of years ago. Well, why shouldn't we require that the professional associations that employ these police officers pay the costs of the abuse of the public inflicted by people who are part of their professional association? That's something that could be done, and it would be interesting to have that conversation, because right now in New York City, of course, you've got the police union actually controlling not only the discipline of the police officers, but the investigation of their misconduct and actually setting policy for the city. That's why arrests on trivial infractions are down 66% since the murder of those two police officers about a week ago. They're not enforcing these small, petty, broken windows type laws because that might entail an element of risk, and risk, of course, is unacceptable if you're a police officer. Officer safety is the highest priority in that profession. It's not the highest priority, incidentally, in the realm of private security. And these are people who, as I mentioned, don't have the luxury of qualified immunity. They actually interpose themselves when necessary between the person of their client or the property that they're paid to protect and criminal threats. And when they engage in misconduct, they don't have the shield and buckler of qualified immunity in a police union and usually a compliant district attorney's office to protect them from accountability. So even the playing field, level of the playing field between the government-employed law enforcement officers and their departments on the one hand, and the much more numerous people in the private security realm who run risks every day and who don't have qualified immunity and who are being paid by the public to provide the protection that the police supposedly provide for us. If law enforcement actually worked to protect persons and property, we wouldn't have to be paying for it ourselves. But if you want that type of protection, you have to pay for it out of your own personal assets, in addition to paying the taxes that support government law enforcement. And I hope that that's going to be something we're going to focus on in this next coming year, because that would be, I think, a subject fraught with all kinds of useful disclosures and, quite frankly, laden with the type of fights we should be having here rather than looking at each other with suspicion on the basis of incidental characteristics that have nothing to do with the matter of the state and its relationship to society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, that's the whole thing is, like we talked about, where the way they've treated people in the ghetto as though they have no rights that the cops are bound to respect whatsoever. That's creeping now. It's getting to all of us now. And, you know, I guess it's Giuliani referenced to, you know, the talk that fathers have to have with their sons and all that has been a controversy. My dad told me, don't you ever mess with the cops if the cops are messing with you. But the way he explained it was, you know, first of all, the assumption was if they're messing with me, I probably did do something wrong, or otherwise, why would they be messing with me? Which probably was a safe assumption because I was a white suburban kid and they mostly didn't have a reason to mess with me. I mean, I had a skateboard, so that was a little something, but didn't quite make me black, though, you know. But then the other thing was, his idea was they were used to dealing with dangerous people all the time, and so you never know what might set them off, and so they're dangerous guys. You should play it safe. But the assumption was that I would make it to the jailhouse alive, you know? And that, right? So it's a totally different thing if he was a black man having a conversation with me as his black son. That, like, you know, these guys might murder you if they get a chance to make it look like somehow it was your fault. So you've got to be really careful. That's an entirely different conversation. And that's a conversation that people of all races are having with their children now, is that these guys are rabid pit bulls. And if you do the slightest thing, they might execute you. You know, like the old wives' tales about how the Crips are looking for someone who will flash their brights at them and then they'll kill you for no reason. Only, no, really, these cops, that's the lesson, that's the thing that fathers are teaching their sons now, that I guess black men have always taught their children and their moms too, and that we all have to learn now. So it really has changed, and I don't know, I really like your ideas, and I think that we can build some consensus around them. Now for the hashtags. So I'll see you on Twitter, Will.
All right. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks so much.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me, you heard it here.
Me. Hey guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Coming up, James Carden. I've never spoken with him before, but I've read a bunch of things that he wrote. And we're going to be talking about Russia. And what the hell is going on? Listen, Will Grigg is a brilliant genius. Will Grigg cares only about liberty. So, and Will Grigg, he didn't work for the Birchers no more. Not for a long, long time. He always was the very best one of them anyway. But he's an independent writer on some of the most important issues in America and doing a job unparalleled. You know, Balco does great work, but his beat is a little bit different. He actually does more breaking stories that, well, I don't know, Will does a lot of breaking stories too. They're a little bit different. I'm not trying to give one credit over the other or whatever. Let there be a contest between all libertarians for who can expose police criminality best. May a thousand blogs bloom. But anyway, Will Grigg, he's absolutely incomparable and indispensable, and he's such a talented writer, and you hear the way he talks, he writes twice as good as that. And he's working on his own, and it's the end of the year, and so happy new year. Guys, dig deep into your pocket and donate to Will. He's got a money bomb going that A.J. Ellis, who, I don't know if A.J. even knows Will. I think he's just a fan of the guy's writing and the fan of his show and stuff. And he set up this money bomb for Will Grigg. GoFundMe.com. You got your pen? Right on the back of your hand. That's what I do. GoFundMe.com/JA1140. That's easy enough. You can even remember that if you're not near anything to type on or write on. /JA1140. GoFundMe.com, or just Google up Mini Money Bomb for Will Grigg and help support his work, would you? Because what are you going to do? Have 2015 without Will Grigg writing about this stuff all day? We can't have that, can we? No, we can't. So, okay, thank you. Now, I'm really sorry that I'm unable to bring you guys Jason Ditz on the show today, because I wanted to ask him about Somalia, too. America bombed Somalia again yesterday. The Pentagon confirmed it. Targeting, you know, some Al-Shabaab higher-up, I don't guess they really said. And I was going to have him catch us up to date on all the latest debunkings of the North Korea thing. I think I can say now that the, not necessarily alternative or underground media, but even just kind of the tech media consensus and the security companies and all that, the consensus is clearly now where the even CNN can't deny it, that North Korea is not behind the hack. And in fact, this one company thinks they found who it is, this former employee. and they know her name and apparently gender and such, and have turned over all their stuff to the FBI, who blew it again, like always. Because they have agendas, you know. This morning on CNN, they were going, well, maybe the North Koreans hired them to do it. Like, no, just you got it wrong again. You failed again. Say that out loud, CNN lady. Say, you failed again. Now you're just making up stuff. Maybe the North Koreans hired them to do it. Based on what? None of the indications that North Korea did it in the first place, which have all been dismissed now? Anyway, so Jason was going to catch us up to date on all the latest debunking of that. He was going to talk to us about the war in Somalia. I'll tell you this about Somalia. You may not know, maybe you do, but I wrote one good article about it. I mean to write a chapter someday, but I wrote one good article about Somalia for the Future Freedom Foundation about a year and a half ago. It's called U.S. Government to Blame for Somalia's Misery. So just Scott Horton, misery. It'll come right up. U.S. government to blame for Somalia's misery. And oh, isn't it so? And isn't it one of the world's worst tragedies? I mean it. It's just absolutely horrible. 250,000 people starved to death, not just from the drought, but from the drought during the chaos created by American intervention in that godforsaken land. So... I'll catch you up on that someday, I guess, on the show someday soon. But if you want to read an article about it, I did my best to kind of put together the whole narrative for you there. U.S. government to blame for Somalia's misery. That's at the Future Freedom Foundation site, fff.org. All right, and then before we get to James Carden here, let me mention, how much time we got? Not much. Let me just mention to you, in case you're not aware, that there was a coup d'etat last February, the night of the 21st, 22nd, in Kiev, Ukraine, after a few months of protests in their maiden square there. And what happened was the Americans forced a deal where the president agreed to pull the police back. And when he did so, the Nazis seized all the government buildings in a coup and drove the president and his lackeys out of town. Now, the guy was a corrupt criminal, whatever. It's an Eastern European, pseudo-democratic piece of crap country. What are you going to do, right? It's always one thug or the other. The last time the American side won in the Orange Revolution of 2004, when they pulled the same sort of stunt in a after a fashion, they ended up being just as corrupt as hell and fighting with each other. And the gas princess ran off with Putin for a little while and then came back again. And, you know, they're a disaster, too. That's just how that goes. Doesn't make the coup legitimate. It was a democratically elected government. At least, not that that really gives it legitimacy over the country, but it certainly undermines the case for it being okay that America and our other foreign state satellite friends helped do a coup d'etat there. But this isn't even a secret. It's not even really disputed that this is what happened. Victoria Nuland from the State Department, the, I always forget her exact title. She's basically the ambassador to the European Union, undersecretary for European affairs. She is on tape talking about how America put $5 billion into bankrolling their friends and their associates and their NGOs and their groups over the last 20 years to help to engineer this thing and their, you know, solidify their control over the country, as well as she's caught on tape with by the Russians, presumably, I guess, plotting the coup d'etat with Jeffrey, oh, crap. It's got a Y in it. I want to say, I can't get it right. Jeffrey. Anyway, the American ambassador to Ukraine. And they're busted on the phone talking about the coup. And, and they used a bunch of Nazis. Real no-fooling, Hitler-loving Nazis. The proud descendants of those who served Hitler in the Holocaust. The Banderist factions. and they've waged a terrible civil war against the eastern provinces who've refused to submit to their rule. And then Russia took Crimea, and then America put a bunch of sanctions on, and next the interview. Now you're caught up.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Pyatt, of course, was the name I was thinking of there that I couldn't quite think of. Jeffrey Pyatt. On to our next guest. It's James Carden. He is a contributing editor at the American Conservative Magazine and at the National Interest as well. The National Interest, it's nationalinterest.org, not the, just nationalinterest.org. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, James?
I'm all right. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you on. Appreciate you joining us today. Your spotlight, Dangerous Escalation, U.S. Backs Putin into a Corner, is the spotlight today on antiwar.com, so people can find it real easy there. And it's quite an article you have here, and I think I'd like to begin where you begin the article, which is the fate of the Russian ruble. Could you please catch us up to date? What has happened to the ruble and why?
Well, since I wrote the article back on the 23rd, not really a whole lot has happened that's very dramatic to report. Today, the ruble seems to be holding at around 55 rubles to the dollar. I have to admit that I did get something wrong in the article. I said that the Russians probably wouldn't deploy any more of their reserves to prop up the ruble. It turns out that they did. They spent roughly 17 billion more. That leaves their reserves at around 400 billion. Most of it's in gold, and I would suspect that they will not rely on any more of their reserves going forward. And I suspect that they will institute currency controls, or soft currency controls anyway, as a way to sort of staunch the bleeding, as they say in the FX markets. Mm. So that's where we are with the ruble right now.
And now, is it losing all its value in Russia as well, or just on all the foreign exchanges? Is it just the other, or how does that work?
Well, it's sort of a mixed bag, right? As the ruble declines, it actually is sort of a boon for their exporters. But what they're seeing is sort of inflationary pressure. So the prices for the average person are rising as a result.
As fast as the value of the money is going down on the foreign exchanges?
Or? Just about.
Yeah.
Yeah, just about. Yeah. I mean, there's probably, a delay of about, a week or two. But yeah, I would say that the effects of the currency markets are felt fairly quickly in terms of affecting the average Russian's expenditures, their pocketbook, and their way of thinking about how they're going to budget going forward.
Mm. And so, what are they doing? Just printing money, or why is the ruble losing so much value?
Well, the ruble is losing value for a number of reasons. I would have to say that the two main reasons have to do with the first being oil. The price of oil has been stagnating at around $40 per barrel. And then the second has to do with the sanctions, and the sanctions are affecting the sort of psychological mood of the market. Russia is increasingly seen as a place that is dangerous to invest, and so they're flows of incoming investment have slowed dramatically. And
so the perceived value of their bonds, basically, on the global market is what's declining.
Well, that's right. It's going to make them, it's going to make their borrowing costs a lot higher, and that puts downward pressure on the ruble.
Right. All right. And so now, what all do you know or do you think is behind the rapid change in the price of oil?
Well, that's a good question. I think one of the underreported aspects of this is OPEC. And it seems to me that the Saudis, who are, to my mind, possibly the world's most sinister regime, are intentionally putting downward pressure on the price of oil to punish Russia for not going along with the plan to oust Assad in 2013. It seems to me that they are intentionally holding the price of oil down in order to punish the Russian economy. And I think that this has a lot to do with Russia's stance over regime change in Syria. I think that the price is artificially low, and I suspect that within the next 6 months that there will be upward pressure on it, and it will probably bounce back up to $80, $90 a barrel, and that will put Russia in a better position, certainly, than it is now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting. I saw Peter Schiff, who is often right about economic bubbles, in his predictions on TV, he was saying that this is because of the end of QE, and that the reason that the price has been so high is because it was an artificially inflated bubble, and now it's popped, and that the stock market bubble and the housing market bubble are to come to their correction as well soon enough, and that the only way to prevent it is for them to go back to the quantitative easing. But then I interviewed this guy, Patrick L. Smith, writing at Salon.com, and he had a very interesting source that was telling him about a meeting between Kerry and I forget which Saudi prince in Jeddah, where it's exactly what you're describing, only including the Americans on the plan that, yes, what we want you to do is just keep overproducing as much as you can in order to really stick it to Russia and Iran, for that matter. But then I hear others in the media saying, no, it's all just because of fracking, because the price was so high for a long time, it made all this shale oil and all this other oil actually profitable to go ahead and invest in recovering. And so now we're reaping the benefit of that, and the correction in the oil price was a long time coming for those reasons. So I just don't know how to sort it out.
Well, I have to say that I read Smith rather religiously, and I think that there's a lot to what he said. I think that I think one of the things that we need to keep in mind, you hear this now all the time, that the United States is now an oil energy superpower. If that's so, and I believe that it is, then the Saudis keeping the price artificially low is also hurting us. So, you know, that's another way to look at it. The price of
that was my first question for him, is what about down in Houston? Are they not, you know, getting their Oswalds ready to fix this situation or what? How long are they supposed to tolerate this?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. That's sort of the wild card, right? It doesn't seem like it has generated very much opposition so far, but that's sort of in keeping with the way that we Americans tend to go about things. We're more than willing to sacrifice our own well-being and our own domestic, you know, welfare in order to, you know, meddle and make things unpleasant for regimes that we don't like abroad. So I can't say that I'm necessarily surprised that the American media has not picked up on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess maybe I just overestimated the influence of James Baker III. I would have thought that he would have put some kind of, you know, old wasp veto on this. Like, hey, now we're talking zillions of dollars in profits. We're talking about this shale oil is not recoverable at $60 a barrel. It's got to be $100 a barrel here.
Yeah, I know. I'm afraid that those days are long behind us, when the wasp ascendancy actually had something to say, or when they had any actual influence on the direction of policy.
That I'm saying I want James Baker in charge. Just I guess I overestimated that influence there.
I suppose that he is preferable to the crowd that we have now running the Republican Party, who are you know, basically a bunch of bloodthirsty neoconservatives. And I think that the Baker generation is certainly, and people like Scowcroft and Bush Sr. are far preferable to the basic, well, you know, this might not be overdoing it too much, the lunatics who are running the asylum now.
Yeah, well, hey, if you're looking at the Weekly Standard or the National Review, there's hardly a better term for them. I don't know what else to say.
that's exactly right.
Yeah, Well, we got bumper music playing, so we got to go out and take this break. When we get back, we'll talk with James Carden. He's at the National Interest and the American Conservative Magazine again. More about this great article, U.S. backs Putin into a corner, and I'll ask about the sanctions and the Ukraine crisis and what's next for America and Russia. James Carden, right after this.
Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the line with James Carden. He writes for the American Conservative Magazine, the anti-war right over there at the American Conservative. And here he is at the National Interest, a very important piece, Dangerous Escalation. U.S. backs Putin into a corner. I was kind of lecturing everybody yesterday on the show, James, about, or was that earlier today, about Henry Kissinger saying what a tragedy it would be. Henry Kissinger, of all people, talking about tragedies of any kind, kind of startling. It would be a tragedy if we reignited the Cold War when it just doesn't have to be. And yet he's really concerned that we are entering an era of a real renewed Cold War with Russia. Now, I know from talking with Andrew Coburn that the military-industrial complex guys are excited about it, as he's reporting for Harper's. But who in the world besides them, besides a bunch of Lockheed salesmen and maybe some, you know, AEI think tankers, want a Cold War with Russia? And do they even realize that they're backing Putin into a corner the way that you describe it in this piece?
Well, I think that I think that you know, it isn't just AEI or Lockheed. The unfortunate thing, and the thing that makes this all very disturbing, is that it's a consensus. The neoconservative sort of fringe has basically a stranglehold on discourse in Washington. There is now very little difference between people who call themselves liberal interventionists or Wilsonians and neoconservatives. In fact, Robert Kagan, this is very amusing, he now refers to himself as a liberal interventionist. Now, this is a cynical ploy on his part because he wants a job in the, you know, next Clinton administration. But it seems to me that the real outliers now are people like Dr. Kissinger and people like Stephen F. Cohen at NYU and people at the American Conservative. It's basically a few, you know, just a handful of, you know, eminent scholars like Kissinger and Cohen and Jack Madlock, who's President Reagan's ambassador, was President Reagan's ambassador to the USSR, and then, you know, people at the American Conservative and the National Interest. But these are not mainstream organs of opinion, as you know. So it seems to me that a couple of things that make this whole new Cold War with Russia very disturbing. One is that it's completely unnecessary, as you had just said. The real tragedy here is with the deaths of over 5,000 civilians in Ukraine and millions of refugees is that none of this had to happen. President Putin, in November of 2013, proposed a tripartite agreement between the EU, Russia, and Ukraine, and it was summarily rejected by Angela Merkel and the EU Commission. And when they rejected that, that put us on the road to where we are today. The first thing is that this is all completely unnecessary. The second thing is that there's a bipartisan neoconservative consensus in Washington that does not either they are unthinking or uncaring about the consequences of this extraordinarily dangerous policy of cornering Russia.
Mm-hmm. You know, I interviewed John Mearsheimer, after prominent realist theorist of the, I guess you could equate him to Scowcroft and them in a way, and they allowed him to write an article at Foreign Affairs after the editor of the journal, Gideon Rose, actually went on the Colbert Report and bragged about American responsibility for the coup. He was big enough to allow Mearsheimer to write an article in Foreign Affairs saying that it was the wrong thing to do. And I guess I kind of hope that with Mearsheimer saying it and with Kissinger saying it and a couple of others, maybe that's it, but somehow that'll chisel through that, hey, come on, we're believing our own propaganda a little bit too much here. America's relationship with Russia is too important an issue for it to be based on, you know, whatever Robert Kagan would have us believe, when we've tried things his way for quite a while now, and it's gotten us into this. Happened to be his wife who got us into this particular mess.
Yeah, I wish that I could share your optimism. I just don't. That could just be maybe the way I am.
I'm not for people respecting Kissinger, but people are supposed to disrespect Kissinger for the right reasons. But in D.C., they respect him because of how horrible he is, so they're supposed to listen to him.
That's right. And there seems to be an endless appetite for these foreign engagements that put our country at grave risk down in Washington. And I see no evidence outside of, again, as we've been saying, a few voices like John Mearsheimer, that article was a real masterpiece. But even Mearsheimer is a marginal voice now because of the controversy from last decade over the Israel Lobby book. So in a sense, while Mearsheimer is certainly the most eminent international relations theorist that we have, unfortunately, his voice is somewhat marginalized as well. And so it seems to me that, we need to do what we can to break through this bipartisan neoconservative consensus, but I'm not hopeful that we'll be able to make much headway, and I'm certainly not hopeful if the president is going to be Mrs. Clinton or Mr. Bush.
It seems like in America, maybe in D.C., a lot of this is, well, sort of like Kissinger implied, a lot of this sort of is imaginary and theoretical. That's sort of how Mearsheimer's piece reads, too. It's all about this belief system and exporting what we call American liberalism now, rather than, you know, real concrete policy. Whereas, of course, from the Russian point of view, we're talking about a military alliance on their borders with, you know, full of Lockheed products, especially, fighter planes and bombers and things. It's a very real thing to them, whereas it's sort of a concept to the guys in all the journals over here.
Right. Well, Mearsheimer said something as he tends to do, he said something very wise on television a few months ago. He said that the idea that we should expect other countries to trust in our benign intentions is a remarkably foolish way to look at the world. And we would never tolerate a military alliance made up of, say, China, Russia, India, whoever, on our border. We're a remarkably secure country. We are surrounded by two oceans, Canada to the north, Mexico to the south. And yet we act as though we live in Grozny. It's sort of extraordinary in a way. And you're right. Theory seems to crowd out reality. And so, to give you an example, right, over the past few weeks, Kyiv, the new government, the new regime in Kyiv, renounced their non-aligned status. So they're paving the way for their entry into NATO. At the same time, Russia has recently, 3 days ago, they revised their military doctrine. The ruble's collapsing. The budget is being squeezed, right? We're pushing Russia into a corner. And what is our answer? Our answer is to pass this ridiculous Ukrainian Freedom Support Act, H.R. 5859, which provides for $350 million in military aid to Kyiv and provides the option for Mr. Obama to add more sanctions against Russia. Well, you know, I don't understand this impulse to destabilize the largest country on Earth with arguably the greatest number of nuclear weapons. They certainly have more tactical nuclear weapons than we do. The idea that this is a good idea to destabilize Russia strikes me as extraordinarily reckless.
Yeah. Well, it seems like, you know, best case scenario from their point of view, they get rid of Putin. It won't be a bunch of, you know, I don't know, orange revolutionaries that get rid of him. It'll be people to his right. It'll be, you know, militarists in Russia who decide that he's too damn liberal to face up to the Americans would be next after him at this rate, correct?
Well, that's exactly right. What are the things that people, especially people who should know better, actually, either they pretend not to understand or don't understand, is that Putin himself is surrounded by high-level politics. He, in the scheme of things over in Russia, is a moderate. There is a hawkish faction in Russia that has been encouraging him to roll right on through to Kyiv. So we have to realize that people who, you know, you hear a lot of talk about Navalny and people like that. Navalny is a hardcore Russian nationalist. Sure, he's an anti-corruption campaigner, and sure, some of his ideas have a lot of merit. But let's not forget, you know, this guy is not someone who is going to tolerate NATO on their borders.
Right. All right. Well, I'm sorry that we have to leave it there. We're all out of time, but thank you so much for your time on the show, James. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
All right, y'all, that's James Carden. He's at nationalinterest.org with this one, Dangerous Escalation, U.S. Backs Putin into a Corner. It's the Spotlight on antiwar.com today. Thanks for listening. See you Friday.